welcome to Claim Edge, your resource for litigated claims management and resolution. I'm Jim Chapman, your host, and my guest today is Stuart Simon, principal consultant at American Jury Centers, a jury consulting firm that helps defense lawyers and their clients successfully position cases for resolution. Stuart has assisted attorneys and corporations in developing trial strategies and tactics from a social science perspective since 1994. Stuart shared his story of how he got into providing jury consulting and trial strategy services for defense attorneys and insurance companies. I enjoyed the conversation, and I'm sure you will too. Because the Claim Edge podcast is focused on litigated claims, today we'll be talking with Stuart about lawsuits that pose the risk of nuclear verdicts and how technology in juror engagement and assessment is helping defense attorneys and their clients avoid those adverse outcomes. Welcome to the Claim Edge podcast. It's great to have you a guest on the show. You started doing work in social science research to help attorneys in litigation almost 30 years ago. You want to tell us how you got involved in that as a consulting practice?
I would. Yeah, I was actually in Miami working at an Admiralty Maritime law firm. Recently out of law school, always had this dream about practicing in Admiralty Maritime, had this love of history, and you're not going to hear a lot of guys say this, but Rhodian sea codes and things like that. So I gravitated towards Admiralty. And, you know, a dear friend of mine was actually recruiting for some partners in a info design, graphics consulting, and kind of strategic consulting firm that was starting in the design district of Miami. It was a couple, three guys. And I was one of the first people they approached. I had a background in art and in education. I had gone to school at night after law school to get certified in a provisional teaching program in the state of New Jersey. The governor at the time, Christy Todd Whitman, had a program where you could get certified as a teacher by taking some exams, which I did and passed those exams. And so I had this background in art and education and the law, and it just so happened that that was a good fit. Met with these guys, and we had started doing what we called info design consulting. And I was one of the principal original consultants early on in that field. So ended up sort of liking that more even than the Admiralty Maritime, and, you know, made the move relatively quickly and became one of the first information design consultants, where started meeting with lawyers in the Miami area and helping them craft educational devices to teach jurors about complex issues in litigation.
So really focused on kind of the trial phase, presentation, helping jurors, helping lawyers teach the jurors what's involved in the case and ultimately try to lead them to the desired outcome. Is that fair?
Yeah, it's really spot on. I mean, you picked up on that, particularly in the phase, right? So, you know, we hadn't necessarily understood at the time, because it was early on in trial consulting at the time, sort of about the evolution of the litigation timeline. So we ended up pretty much focused on pre-trial, post-discovery prep. And yeah, the purpose was to see if we could take complex issues, whether it would be in medical malpractice, engineering, technology, patent, and put together devices that would allow not only the lawyers, but the witnesses to be perceived as educators rather than persuaders. So could we craft material that allowed them on their feet to sort of get the highest and best compliment that jurors can pay people, which is that person taught me something.
It sounds like there was sort of this ongoing evolution of social science, research in social science, persuasion, that sort of thing, that brought that on. Was that your experience?
It's an interesting question, because historically there was a division of labor in the consulting world, so much so, Jim, that the American Society of Trial Consultants early on didn't recognize consultants who didn't have a background or a PhD in psychology. So folks who did information design or technology consulting, animators, graphic artists, they couldn't be members initially. And then there was this convergence, as you just pointed out, that was the marriage between social science and various forms of persuasion, if you will, right? Of educating and devices and tools. And I think that's really where the profession made its greatest leap forward was to recognize that the approach had to be multifaceted. It couldn't just be psychology. There had to be more than that to really meet the needs of the, you know, the end users.
Just kind of thinking about that, you guys, you in particular, and of course your team at American Jury Centers have been focused on that process. But how was it impacted, you know, most recently by the pandemic?
It's a great question. And without doing too much of the Wayne's World, like go to that time machine, you know, social science research in that sort of litigation world kind of mirrored what social science research looked like sort of globally at the time, right? So it had been thought of as kind of focus groups and mock trials historically, live in-person work where you're sitting down with folks and leaning in almost in that Phil Donahue kind of interview style, right? What do you think about that? And that world changed. It changed for a variety of reasons, but I think one of the greatest leaps forward, like many things in life, happened because of challenges that we're faced with, and the pandemic created that challenge. Hard to get together with folks. It was difficult to get realistic samples of populations and veneers because there are folks who, you know, were skeptical about coming out, and facilities, you know, market research facilities were limited in the number of people they could invite. They were putting up like plastic barriers between participants and had a lot of spacing issues. So, you know, it was sort of adapt or be absorbed, which, you know, there wasn't a massive consolidation among the vendors who provided the physical plant, the places we could go to do these studies. My gosh, so many of them disappeared. Partners that I had, you know, valued our relationships with for decades just got swallowed up by the hardship. So the answer to your question is we had to adapt, and the way we adapted was by developing new and unique kind of leading edge forms of social science research.
Obviously, you had to engage in some alternative approaches.
Oh, yeah, no question.
How has that changed, improved, or perhaps made more challenging the work that you've been doing?
You know, as I said, historically, a lot of this work was done in person. There were technological advances in the in-person studies that made them more powerful, but it was pretty consistent that it was something that was done on location. So for clients, whether those clients be attorneys or carriers or excess carriers or actually corporations, there was a substantial cost component. This change was sort of multifaceted in that, one, it altered the manner in which these studies had to be conducted, because they had to be done a large part virtually. Some were done online, so it was still the classic study. And like a lot of things in life, we're resistant to change. So we stay close to the core, which is let's have it look and feel like a focus group or a mock trial, but we'll do it in a virtual setting. I was not in huge favor of that. So as a company, what we decided was that survey methodology, utilizing substantially larger ends, more people, and accessing them through different platforms. So we pushed ourselves to think about ways that we could do that. What we decided was we would craft a form of surveying that would allow our clients to post online to password-protected websites a narrative of a case, roughly 2,500 words in length, 1,250 words per side. It could be seasoned and interspersed with demonstrative exhibits, video vignettes, surveillance video, photographs from scenes, documents, contracts, in a Med-Mal case, images, x-rays, whatever you have. And that we would ask folks, we would recruit jurors from the venue and ask them to take those surveys. Those surveys could be completed in roughly 14 to about 18 minutes. And we were able to do that and collect substantially larger sample sizes. So much so that we were finding we were getting 250 surrogate juror responses in relative short order, where in prior studies, we would get 24 to 36 in a focus group or a mock trial. Now, make no mistake, a focus group or a mock trial might be a substantially deeper dive. But what we were learning was the value proposition in the statistical relevance, if you will, of the sample size. and the dramatic decrease in cost by eliminating those things that really amped it up: travel, facility rental, audiovisual, catering, parking, right? Hotel, airfare, all those kinds of things. For about 75 or 80% less than a standard study, we were delivering 10 times the power statistically.
That is a phenomenal result to be able to get to, you know, the same sort of confidence level, actually probably a higher confidence level because the sample size is so higher. Much larger, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
It's funny, you think about, it's all about the data, right? You're getting almost 10 times the amount of data for a fraction of the price, and that's just got to be a phenomenal win-win for your clients, right?
If we believe what we say, and I do, which is our mission is, and you know, you and I have had this discussion, is to help position our clients in various points along the litigation timeline to improve the likelihood of resolution. That's our mission. And so a substantial component of that is sort of acknowledging that we don't want to be an impediment to that. Like, that's like the first thing you have to say to yourself is, you know, and I've asked myself that for 30 years. There have been many times where I've spoken to clients when they've said, I feel like maybe the cost of this study that you're thinking about doing or engaging in may impede the potential for you to resolve this case. These studies don't do that. And so what this cost component has done is allowed clients to sort of disregard the fundamental objection they've had to social science research, which was historically, my case isn't large enough. So what I love so much about this product is that it allows clients to endeavor to take a measurement, even pre-filing in a case, and collect data that might instruct them on the positioning of resolution even before a lawsuit is filed, on thinking about discovery, on thinking about language that they might use in describing events and incidents. And so I really feel like what it's done is removed a lot of the barriers to social science research and the objections that are quite reasonable, which are, my gosh, you know, with that cost, I'd be better off applying that towards settlement. Or, you know, maybe I'll just wait until we see if the case survives summary judgment or see how discovery goes. I can tell you that the application of this type of research has become so broad-reaching because it can be injected very steeply into various components, right? Various moments in time along that timeline. To me, that's what this is all about, you know, is being there for our clients when they decide they need us, not when they can afford us.
Yeah, and that they don't have to wait till it's trials imminent and, you know, it's turned into a piece of litigation that they can't resolve. And they're trying to figure out, well, what's the best presentation strategy for addressing the jury or dealing with it at trial, right?
Yeah. I mean, as much as I enjoy that component of the work, if you and I are intellectually honest and we look at the statistics, and if it's somewhere around 3% of cases that actually get tried, I'd not only have a business that didn't make a lot of sense, a business model, but I'd also have not be living up to the promise, which is I want to help the client resolve the case whenever that is, right? So the beauty of it is that you're 100% right. That moment in time can come a whole lot earlier when folks have that earth-shattering or, you know, that light that shines upon them that moment. And who's to say that can't happen even pre-filing in a case?
The pandemic kind of created or mushroomed for you this newer business model. Obviously you've learned a lot and been learning a lot about jurors through that, right? More data, more information points, that sort of thing. What is it that you've actually learned, right, about jurors, right? Can you pull the curtain back a little bit?
Yeah. Oh, I'd love to. You know, this starts with sort of being a bit of a data nerd, right? Well, maybe more than a bit, but what the pandemic allowed us to do. So I'll give you an example. So in our first year, we did roughly 100 studies of this type, which gave us access to somewhere. Now, one of the studies actually involved 3,000 jurors. So we ended up approaching about 30,000 jurors. Now, in a really good year of doing in-person social science research, you might tap into 300, 400, 500, 600 jurors. So when we in our studies embedded additional studies, for example, we studied the Me Too movement. We studied people's reaction to the police and policing. We did a comprehensive analysis on something I'll refer to as copers versus quitters. And so I'll go into that a little bit for you and tell you why it's so important. So what we found when we were out there doing these surveys and getting such substantial aggregate data, what we found was that people were really sharing a lot with us about the experience during the pandemic. How were they managing? How were they managing physically, psychologically, and economically? And when we started not only positing those questions, but then taking the knowledge we were gaining from these surveys and applying it to virtual jury selections, which we did a great many of during the pandemic, particularly in Washington State, and with our partner attorneys in representing their clients, we're able to voir dire people in the comfort of their homes and continue the process of comparing the aggregate data that we were collecting to their real life experience. We got this confluence. We got what we refer to, and I'm not a social scientist by training. I'm a lawyer by training. I've got a coin here somewhere I can show you. I've been clean and sober from the practice of law for almost 30 years. But this coin, but at the same time, have learned so much from the social scientists that I've worked with and employed over these decades that I understand how to design research in a way to take emotion and take ego out of it. So what we learned from these folks is that there was this really clear dichotomy. There were people that were managing their way through the pandemic, and those people came in all shapes and sizes, all colors, race, gender, ethnicity, and socioeconomic status. I'll give you an example of a fella who was in Seattle who had 3 or 4 kids in his house. I can't remember specifically, but he was really struggling to make ends meet. So he found himself teaching algebra to a son, and he hadn't had math in 20 years. And he wanted his kids to be able to work out, but he couldn't afford a gym membership. So he took broom handles and empty Tide bottles and filled them with gravel and showed up. He made a weight training facility in his house. Now, that's a guy who is a coper. That's a guy who managed to find a pathway through the pandemic. So when we started, we literally developed this paradigm, copers versus quitters. Fairly obvious who the copers are, and we should not prejudge who they could be. We didn't. What we found was it was really easy to talk to those folks and ask them questions about how they were managing. So they were people who did the very things that we just talked about. Khan Academy, do-it-yourself projects, figuring out how to get through this and come out on the other side of it. There was also another end of that spectrum. There were folks who just said, I'm just waiting until it's over. I don't have control over my destiny right now, so all I can do is be patient. I'm not going to start a Facebook things for sale or for free in Des Moines business because that's not who I am. But there were a lot of people who did, and they sold stuff on local sites and they put it outside their door and they met a lot of people and they delivered meals and they ended up becoming better people than they'd ever anticipated. And that's a coper, but there are quitters too.
That's an interesting kind of attitudinal piece of research that you're able to embed into your surveys. Do you get the sense that people are more open about sharing that type of information or answering those type of questions today or maybe during the pandemic in a way that they might not be as open?
But you used the key word, share. You and I both know that this was a shared experience, that regardless of who we are and where we live, we certainly could find commonality with people if we were open to discussing it. And that's what we found was the segue. And so I love your question, and I want to share with you the way it impacts attorneys directly. So historically, when an attorney would invite a juror or a court would invite jurors of an IRA to appear to have a jury selection, lawyers would say, welcome to our world. We know this is weird for you But this is what we do all the time. We got you, right? Not during the pandemic. When we got on a Zoom link and lawyers were late or couldn't figure out how to log in or couldn't interact with documents, it was a shared experience. So much so that wasting a potential juror's time in that Zoom setting was quite dangerous for an attorney in that process, and the courts didn't appreciate it. So if you could acknowledge that this was new and unique for both of us, that went a long way to creating a bridge for conversation. Now, an attorney sitting at home doing voir dire with a potential juror, and the attorney has a Nautilus home gym and an e-bike sitting behind them, and our guy has barbells made out of sticks and Tide bottles, that might be a fairly significant disparity. So obviously, right, the physical characteristics of the place you were engaging from were relevant, but the experience, the commonality of the experience was quite shared. And we felt very good as a company and working with our partner attorneys and clients that we knew how to talk to people about that and listen for what was going on and then ask them the right follow-up questions about how they were doing and managing. And so that dichotomy of coper versus quitter, you can well imagine how that plays out in the process of listening to, thinking about, and talking about in deliberations about a case, if you're a juror, and how it might affect the way that you look at things.
Obviously, a lot of lessons that you've unpacked there from the whole pandemic experience. How, kind of going forward, right, people are itching to get back to, I'll call it, live in-person trials. They're starting to happen. The courts are finally starting to clear their criminal dockets. Civil cases are getting set for trial again in the courthouse, so to speak, right? What's next? Where does that research that you've been able to do kind of take you into the next phase? The kind of, I'll call it, hopefully, a return to normalcy.
Yeah, you know, it's an interesting question. And I'll tell you that sometimes what we want isn't always what we need. And so what I'll say to you is there are byproducts of this window in time, this snapshot of the pandemic, that it would be really, it's really important that some of them survive. So I'll kind of share with you, there was an expedited version of time qualification, voir dire, and jury selection, including the application and use of supplemental juror questionnaires, that I really hope survive into the future of litigation because they make all of us better at what we do. So historically, the courts, many courts welcome the use of supplemental juror questionnaires. Questionnaires aimed at understanding potential jurors' capacity to sit and listen to and decide a case. Many times we would hear from clients, particularly lawyers, oh, this judge won't like that. They don't like that. Well, guess what? One, that wasn't always the case, but you had to ask. You got to ask for what you want if you're hoping to get it. But the other thing that we saw was during the pandemic, the courts very clearly understood that the issuance of a supplemental juror questionnaire had the potential to not only expedite the jury selection process, but to make it far more equitable. And so what we saw was the courts saying, you know, these written questionnaires, why don't we think about how to do these electronically? So historically, you would do a supplemental juror questionnaire. People would come in and fill it out on paper. They'd leave the courthouse, come back for the day of jury selection. The court would copy the supplemental juror questionnaire, disperse it between and among the parties. We would analyze it. We would create informational sheets for the lawyers and our clients, and then we'd go to jury selection. Courts said, that's stupid. What we really should do is send it out electronically. Why force these folks to come to the courthouse? So they now could fill out the SJQ electronically. It could populate an Excel spreadsheet. And then the data would come back and it would just be so easy to use that it made all of us better at selecting and deselecting jurors. So one thing we've learned is that process is better than the one we used to use. And every case should use a supplemental juror questionnaire. Now, I'm not saying that's going to be the result, but I will say to you is there's an understanding out there that there's a way to do this that has tremendous utility, creates a lot of fairness, and doesn't waste the time of jurors, doesn't force them to come downtown before they're needed. That's one aspect of it. This return to quote unquote normalcy, I mean, in many ways could be enhanced through some of these lessons that we learned. And that's only just one example of it. Lots of these things, there have been a number of things, whether it's been through the use of virtual depositions, through witnesses being able to testify remotely because it was more convenient, whatever these things are, I think they've streamlined and improved trials. And I will tell you, the cases that we tried to verdict virtually that we participated in, I thought were really well done, really balanced. It was a excellent use of time. Jurors were tremendously appreciative when they could participate that way, and it worked quite well. I did a speech a couple months ago where I said to the audience, imagine if you would, historically, that all cases throughout the history of man had been tried virtually, just always had been done online. And then one day you got a letter in the mail that said, we need you to report downtown. We need you to take time off from your job, leave your kids, the comfort of your home. We're going to pay you roughly a couple bucks a day. This trial might last 6 months and you could be sequestered. How do you feel about that? Think about what we would have said about the absurdity of the shift from technology to the analog in that case. So it's, you know, it's a lot of it's about the perception.
Yeah, totally. I love the idea of, you know, filling out almost a Google survey, right, for a supplemental jury questionnaire. Most courts have the prospective jurors fill out an initial questionnaire, you know, just verifying what their current employment is, right? Simple
exactly.
Things like that. And you know, to be able to collect that information electronically as opposed to send you a form, fill it out, put it back in snail mail. Somebody's still got to collate it. Maybe they, you know, miskey the entries. I mean, there's so many things that can go wrong in that process, right?
You're 100% right. Yeah, there's so many confounds. And you know, we as a profession, all of us sort of collectively, when we think we're on the cutting edge, we're not, right? You know that. I mean, you know that better than anybody. It's one of those kind of funny things where, you know, when we got barcode technology for presenting documents at trials, we thought we'd landed on the moon. And then you went to, you know, Mississippi to try a case, and some guy on the jury was like being asked if he thought it was too technologically advanced. He had an Xbox on, you know, and a satellite dish on the roof of his double wide. And what he was doing at that time was 10 times more powerful than what we were contemplating.
Totally. So you mentioned earlier that your clients are typically defense attorneys, insurance companies, reinsurance companies, folks that are involved typically in defending claims or defending against claims. What is it that motivated you to start a company, right, that focuses on providing services to the defense side, to carriers and defense attorneys?
It's interesting. One, the tendency from the clients that we serve is an understanding about sort of litigation and the process. So when we think about success, when we think about success on the defense side, what do we think about? Sometimes we think about degrees of losing. Sometimes we think about, right? So there's an understanding that if there's someone out there who can assist us in positioning ourselves at different points to do better, there's value in that. And so I have found, not just because I like it better or because I believe, you know, in balancing the scales, but for me, a lot of it is this recognition and this reality that litigation, having a little more power, whether it's a handful of percentage points or slightly more than that, it could enhance someone's position, that there's value there. The other is, you know, I wanted to be on the side that what my experience had taught me was trying to do the right thing. I mean, if you understand, and I know you do, insurance companies pay claims. When insurance companies don't pay claims, it's not because their first line of defense is to reject. It's because they have a belief that there's a reason not to pay it. And so, you know, I found a clarity in that. And so for us, it was exciting, enhancing the possibility, right, of an outcome that was intellectually more honest. We really believe in that. And so, you know, do we also have to couple that with the realities that our clients have? Well, of course we do. As much as I'd like to take everything to verdict, I get it that what I'm actually trying to do is position my client at different points for the best potential outcome. That's our motivation.
The key is, can you position it for the right resolution and at what, you know, at the right time? You know, what's the right inflection point to achieve that?
Yeah, I mean, I have been lucky enough over the years to pretty much work for the same folks for a very long time, whether it's been the corporations or the carriers. And I have, in all those years, I honestly sit here today, I cannot reflect on an experience where a client of mine didn't want to pay somebody who was entitled to get paid. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm just I can't think of one in almost 30 years. And I can't say the same. I've been called on plaintiff's cases, and I can't say that every time I got called, they weren't telling me, well, we don't know if we're right, but we think we got a good shot to win. So it's a different deal. You know, the other thing is a significant motivation for me, and I think I may have mentioned this to you recently, particularly in the development of this particular product. One of my very first experiences in litigation as a consultant was on one of the first, if not the first, bad faith case in Florida. It goes back almost 30 years. It was an awful car accident that took place in the Boca Raton area. It was just a tragic case. And when I think about a variety of things, when I think about sort of reptile theory, when I think about bad faith, so much of it comes down to sort of valuing and sort of scoring claims and sort of prioritizing them appropriately. So one of the things that I'm really committed to, and this may sound a little crazy, but I'd like to be around and help do away with bad faith. It's something I'm committed to, and I actually believe that the platform that I've developed and the price point that I've been able to introduce it at, one of the reasons I've done that is because I'd like to see it adopted across the board for evaluating risk associated with all files. And because I'd like adjusters and those they report to be able to say, we took a look at this case very early on and it scored in a way that was consistent with something that could be resolved or should be resolved, but it wasn't ripe in this moment in time, rather than what you and I both know, which is the ultimate setup that's going on out there, you know, in the plaintiff's bar, setting up adjusters and insurance companies for bad faith. So that's another a big driver for me, was developing a system, a scoring system that was affordable, that made sense for every case, that could help potentially do away with bad faith.
That is very aspirational, and obviously it's a significant issue in a lot of jurisdictions. Maybe not everyone, but a lot of jurisdictions, and quite an experience you had when you got started in this business, seeing that, having a front row seat to it, right?
Yeah, I mean, and unfortunately, I mean, good or bad, I'm considered sort of somebody who does a lot. We do a lot of bad faith work, and they're challenging cases. And just to be perfectly blunt with you, I got tired of values being assigned to those claims without the benefit of, you know, some form of research, without the benefit of a fairly significant N. I want to see those in the files.
Well, it seems to me also, I mean, you know, we live in this age, everybody talks about social inflation, increasing litigation rates, at least in a number of jurisdictions, maybe not everywhere, the risk of nuclear verdicts, I don't know, in every type of case, but certainly that's expanding as well. And it seems to me that the offering that you have, particularly around, you know, being able to kind of check in at the inception and at various places throughout the life of a lawsuit, presents a real opportunity to engage in some avoidance and deeper understanding around making the decision about going to trial.
Yeah.
Right.
No, I think, I mean, I couldn't agree with you more. And yeah, I appreciate you recognizing that. And I think that that's part of the promise, I hope, that we make, whether it's as consultants or outside counsel or, you know, advisors in the industry. I mean, I know you're like me, a believer in technology enhancing, you know, the capacity to handle these issues and claims. we get better at that. I think we are constantly driving towards reducing risk.
Absolutely.
And that's got to be the mission.
So I know one of the other things that, you know, in terms of services that you're involved in is, I'll call it, if I can, witness training or at least communication skill training. How does that work?
Well,
what's involved with that?
You know, Jim, I'm kind of a big deal in that realm because I wrote a book that sold 11 copies. So, you know, I joke around about that, but I'm very proud of this little thing, but I think it was Dudley Moore in the, what was the movie he did? Arthur. You remember the movie Arthur?
Sure.
Where Dudley Moore says, "She's a princess from a very small country." They recently got wall-to-wall carpeting. You know, I'm intellectually honest about the reality. So, but I did, you know, I've got this book out there and it is a blue book on witness communication training. You know, it's one of the things I'm most proud of in the work that I've done because, you know, that I do a lot of witness prep and I did some today. And I genuinely get to say this at the outset. So I am lucky enough that the clients who bring me in, the carriers typically who bring me in, are able to decide that they want a witness to have a good experience. And I have so much respect for the companies that engage me in that way because they're not necessarily just worried about the outcome of the case. They want the witness from one of their insured, whomever it might be, to have a good experience. Not for this to serve as a ceiling over their heads in their life so that they're burdened with it. And I can genuinely tell you when I get called from carriers, and I do often, I mean, multiple times every day, their motivation is not just, we need you to prep this guy so we can win. We need you to prep this guy because he's struggling. He's scared. He's nervous. He's having a difficult time expressing himself. So I'm able to convey to the people that I'm there to help. You're lucky enough to have somebody who wants you to have a good experience without regard for the outcome of the case. So from my perspective, fundamentally, that makes my job really quite joyous. And that is when I get to help someone, I get to help them as a person to assure that they communicate their personal truth as well as they can. Now, if it furthers the case, great. But if it doesn't, well, guess what? That's something we need to know too.
Yeah. And at the end of the day, if the witness has got a significant role to play in the case, it can be a very powerful way of them feeling supported and having the confidence, as they approach that witness experience, right?
No question. And I get so much pleasure out of that. So yeah, there's this process that I go through where I kind of inundate people unrelated to the facts of a case about what a deposition is going to be like. And it's not, I'm not doing theatrical training. I mean, this is like State Department kind of stuff where we're talking to people about physical positioning and you know, how to control pace and tempo of questioning, how to listen to and think about and respond to questions, the kind of language that creates space for a witness. Every adjuster, every executive as an insurance company has heard the following question in a deposition, whether they were a fact witness or a 30B6. You would agree, sir, would you not, that the single most important thing an insurance company does is protect the interest and assets of its insured? Well, boy, does that sound reasonable, and boy, is it a load of crap, right? But everybody hears that question. It's a scary one because you and I both know lawyers are great at asking questions that sound incredibly reasonable. But at the same time, they're not really true what the statement is that lawyer's making. And yes, while it is true that that's an important component of what an insurance company does, to say that it's the single most important thing all the time would be disingenuous and dishonest. So my job is to help folks relax and focus enough to recognize that things that sound very, very reasonable aren't always true.
And I won't ask you to give away all of the state secrets, but there are a number of similar questions that often come up in kind of the reptile approach to litigation that it can be super helpful to prepare a witness to how they're going to experience them and to think clearly around the answers that that they provide, right? So around the technology, right? I'm assuming that most of that witness work is done today via Zoom. You don't have to travel to meet with anybody, or they don't have to travel to meet you.
Yeah, two things. One, I love that you brought up the reptile piece. And, you know, it's so funny that our job, you know, when we think about preparing folks, is not to tell them, hey, if they ask those kind of questions, we're going to object and we're not going to let you get exposed to that. Because that's not what the guy, that's not what the witness wants to hear. It's like, really? You're that worried about me that you're not going to let me speak? So as it relates to reptile, you know, you know that the questions are quite similar to the one that I asked, right? It's like, you know, as a construction company, as an educator, as a school district, the single most important thing you do is protect the health, safety, and welfare of our children. Now, that's a broad question, right? I mean, that's not related to the facts of the case. And easy to get sucked in and go, well, yeah. I mean, what could be more important than that? No, you're totally right. You want to say it that way. But all of these questions require you to sit back and think and say, we take the safety of our children very seriously, but I can't agree with you that at every moment in time, it's the single most important thing we do. So somebody would then say, well, what's more important than safety? Well, I never said anything was more important than it, but our world is quite organic and we're balancing a great many factors in the work that we do. That's how we handle those issues, by seizing control of something they think they have control over. You know what I want the lawyer to say, but the lawyer won't say, is, oh, so you're not saying it's not the most important thing, but you are saying there's this balance of other issues. What are they? I'm so curious. Educate me. They're not going to say that. What they're going to say is, what's more important, right? Tell me, like, rank these things, because the lawyer wants to establish sequence. Safety is the most important thing. And if you are foolish enough to say, well, the financial success of our corporation is more important than safety, right? That's fool's gold. So to your point, technology in my life has dramatically changed this component of the work that I've done. So historically, much like the issues you and I discussed at the outset, when cases were headed towards trial or in critical cases, they would say to me, fly into LA, spend 3 to 5 days with my guys. That would be great. Well, for as much as a decade, I've been saying to clients, and many have adopted it, let's use some other form of doing this. In fact, when iPad technology first came out, I purchased iPads for many of my clients and gifted them to them so that we could do witness prep that way. But there was still this idea that, hey, we got to get together in person. You got to get face to face with my people. Well, you know what? This Zoom technology, or whatever you want, whichever one you like, created a unique thing. And that was the ability for you and I to move in and out of these conversations and then effectively disengage and go back to the thing that we were doing. Well, witness prep works like medicine. Medicine works on two things and two things only: frequency and dosage. So does witness prep. And so if I can get 2 hours with somebody to explain the baseline elements of communication theory, and then send them off to go walk their dog and pick up their kids, invariably what I find out is what I taught them that day gets applied first, not in witness work, but in communication with people they care about. Mm-hmm. And they will come back to me and say, you know what? I did what you said in a conversation with my teenage daughter, and I was good. I listened before I spoke. And then we reconvene for step two. What I love about that is that rather than sending my client a bill for 2 hours of witness prep and $3,500 of travel, which is insane to me and always has been, now what I'm finding is my clients are buying into the program that I've been explaining to them for a very long time, which is, let me have 5, 6 distinct sessions with this individual, but let's do them staggered. Let's start out slowly. Let's let them recess back into their life. Let's reconvene and do a mock examination. Then let them leave and think about that. And let's come back and let's reboot and try again. Let's wash, rinse, and repeat, right? And I'm a really big believer in that. I do not think marathon sessions with witnesses produce good testimony. I just don't.
Yeah, I don't disagree with that at all. In fact, it sounds like you're doing more therapy than communication training.
Well, you know what? I mean, and it is in a lot of ways, but the truth is that good witnesses are relaxed witnesses. Yeah. Good witnesses are witnesses that are focused and that, you know, understand sort of the balance of power between the lawyer and themselves. And that doesn't happen from rushing them. That happens from slowly articulating this stuff and letting them experience it and get the feeling. Like, I had a witness today who, when I first met her, she was going to hang herself with her own testimony. Mm. Just the way she was testifying, she was literally her own executioner. And today she wanted to show me how far she'd come. So we practiced today and I said to her, "How'd you get to work today?" And she said, "By car." I said, "I like where you're going." I said, "What kind of car?" She said, "I don't know." And I said, "You don't know what kind of car you drive?" She said, "I didn't drive." And I said, "Oh, I'm liking how you're doing." I said, "Who did?" She said, "I don't know." And I said, "You don't know? Did you take a car service?" And she said, "I did." "Which one?" She said, "Lyft." And I said, "Oh, was he driving a new car or an old car?" She said, "Well, I guess that would depend on your perspective, Mr. Simon." And I was like, "Oh, have you come a long way?" But, you know, so think about that exchange, right? And it doesn't sound like a lot, but one of the most important things to convey to a witness is you have no duty or obligation to help a lawyer use their time better. When a witness does what she did today, it tells me that every question is existing as an island and that she is willing to ramp these things up just one incremental click at a time. Everybody on this podcast knows what witnesses do poorly, and that is blah. Just all of it, hoping if I just say it all, you'll let me out of here faster. And that's just not how it works, you know? So that's the exciting thing about these sort of incremental sessions is people adopt things and they apply them in their life and then they come back and they're able to demonstrate that they've learned it, retained it, and can apply it. That's very exciting. And because I know that when they move on from this experience testifying, like the experience I've had for almost 30 years with folks I've been doing at every level, they're better people. They're better communicators, which is exciting. And that's really rewarding.
So I can tell what really motivates you is doing good things for your clients. It really shines through. And I have to say, yeah. I've really, this has been a great conversation.
Oh, man, it's been fun for me, too. And I have had a bunch of them. It's always fun talking to you. Yeah.
Love everything that you shared. If folks want to get in touch with you after this podcast, what's the best way to reach out to you?
You know, my email address or, you know, through my website. My email is Stuart, S-T-U-A-R-T, at my-AJC, like AmericanJuryCenters.com, Stuart at my-AJC.com. You can see us at www.AmericanJuryCenters.com. That's a great way. And my cell phone, if you want to share that, I mean, that's the number's 561-542-8590. And awesome. It's always on. And yeah. Okay. Yeah. We love talking about cases and, you know, and helping people advance their cause.
Well, fantastic.
Yeah, it's been fun talking to you. Thanks for having me.
You bet. Have a great day, Stuart.
Yeah, you too.
It was a real pleasure having Stuart Simon from American Jury Centers as a guest on the Claim Edge podcast. I hope you enjoyed our conversation about lawsuits, jury research, theme development, and witness preparation in litigated claims. As Stuart mentioned, if you want to connect with him, you can do that on LinkedIn or by email at Stuart, S-T-U-A-R-T, at my-AJC.com. Thanks for listening today. If you like this episode of Claim Edge, please subscribe on your favorite podcast channel and share it with your colleagues and friends. Until next time, this is Jim Chapman on the Claim Edge podcast, signing off.